I'm Kate Remington. I'm talking with Frederick Chu, and I'm really looking forward to having a chat about your brand new recording of Liszt's transcriptions of Beethoven's Fifth and Seventh Symphony. So yeah. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You know, these transcriptions, it's surprising, but they're not very well known. And we could start there. Why aren't they better known?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One, the fact that they're just very difficult to play. Mm-hmm. They're extremely technically challenging. In fact, probably some of the most difficult things I've ever worked on. And, you know, logical, because you're trying to get all of the voices that are in the orchestra played by, you know, 50, 70 people down to 10 fingers
right.
and one person. So, of course, it's really hard. I think second, at the time of their writing, the piano was the instrument that allowed people to that allowed music to disseminate. Mm-hmm. And now we have recordings, we have live music, we have the internet, we have just access to all this recorded stuff and live stuff. And we don't need the piano anymore to be the disseminator of music. So for me to bring this back now is really to show how important these transcriptions are as a document. Just imagine if we had a recording from Beethoven's time of somebody, you know, who knew Beethoven, who worked with Beethoven, performing the symphonies, conducting the symphonies. Just imagine that.
Yeah, I think about that all the time.
Of course, we don't have that, but we have these transcriptions, which are about as close as we can get. Number one, because Liszt was an amazing genius composer, mm-hmm. and he empathized with Beethoven, understood the genius of Beethoven well before even many of his colleagues appreciated Beethoven. He was a conductor during his 30s and 40s. He took a position in Weimar as a court conductor, basically, and took the time to compose and was basically retired from performing. So he conducted these pieces as a performing conductor.
Yeah.
He's a performer. He knows what it is to get out on stage and perform these things. He knew Beethoven. Beethoven kissed him on the forehead when he was a little kid.
I love that story.
And he was a sympathetic ear. He wanted to bring out the genius of Beethoven. You can read some of the contemporary critiques of Beethoven. You know, there's the famous reviews of the symphony performances that are just like, you know, Beethoven is crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, what, he's writing this junk and this trash, and you know, like it's cacophony. You know, Liszt couldn't say more good things about Beethoven, and he also had this platform of notes to actually transcribe what he heard himself in terms of the orchestral performances of the time, how Beethoven conducted. Liszt may have even heard Beethoven himself conduct. Who knows?
Yeah.
I don't know that detail. But he certainly knew and heard conductors who had worked with Beethoven, people who had played for Beethoven mm-hmm. in the orchestras. And so you can't get a closer eyewitness or ear witness than Liszt for these symphonies. And then for him to actually write down details to the note in these transcriptions is just an incredible opportunity for us to open, you know, it's a door into that world of performance practice and what was it that was exciting about Beethoven? What was crazy about that music?
Well, it's so interesting to think about a time when people didn't understand Beethoven's music. And so how did Liszt's transcriptions help people become more familiar with it?
Well, he was, he was this incredible charismatic superstar of the time. He, in his 20s and 30s, basically for 10 years, toured nonstop across the entire Western universe. And he was a conduit for all the music that he wanted to promote. And of course, he wrote music himself, so he promoted his own music. But he also played music of Beethoven. He also played music of his contemporaries. He played music of Schubert. Things that he discovered and appreciated because of his genius and his that rare chance that he had to be able to travel to all these different capitals and little places and meet all the people who were up and coming. And he became a kind of an MTV for the generation. I'm going to play stuff for you, the audience, and this is what's cool. And he was bringing this music to people who otherwise probably would not have had much opportunity to go to an orchestra concert to hear a Beethoven symphony. You know, they were difficult even for orchestras to perform at the time. You had to find a conductor who would be amenable to working with the orchestra on a new symphony. And then you had to, you know, be able to afford to go to the performance. So you know, there weren't that many orchestras. There weren't that many performances live that, where you could hear this music. So to go hear Liszt playing one of these is could possibly have been the very first time that many of these people heard the Beethoven symphonies.
Wow.
And Liszt knew that.
Yeah.
And so he specifically transcribed a few of the popular ones, the number 5, number 6, number 7. Those were the three that were really popular at the time. And he composed the first version of his transcriptions for those performances and got the music out to people. After he retired from performing and went through this stint as a conductor-composer, this is just so absolutely incredible. He took 2 years off for a retreat.
Wow.
He found a little cell in a monastery outside of Rome, and the cell had a small bed, a small desk, and a small piano, a pianola. And he spent 2 years secluded, basically working on transcribing all 9 symphonies of Beethoven for piano.
Wow.
Because he knew that he had done this work for 5, 6, and 7, and that they were successful. It was possible to do, but he wanted to take time and do it better. And he wanted to do the whole thing. And he had a challenge from his publisher. I want you to transcribe all 9. And he took that challenge. And he spent that time to do it because he realized he would be the only person to be able to do it that faithfully and with that kind of enthusiasm, composer's insight, performance insight, all those things that I mentioned.
Yeah.
He was unique. And he had to do it, and he did it.
Wow, it's a fascinating story.
Incredible story.
So I'm wondering, you know, in the context of this really amazing age of music, what are some of the clues in Liszt's transcription that make you think that this really is much closer to Beethoven's intention as opposed to, you know, the scores that are
right.
published now?
Well, there are a couple of little details, you know, the second movement, that famous dun, 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 which was so popular even when Beethoven conducted it with the orchestra. I think the premiere of that symphony with Beethoven conducting, they had to encore the second movement before they could even play the third movement.
That's amazing.
In the middle of the symphony, they had to encore the second
wow.
movement. So that in that particular movement, there are a couple of details that really point out how unique these transcriptions, the perspective is. One is this little grace note that's in the main melody. And there's a, not controversy, but there are two different ways to perform it. One is on the beat, mm-hmm. da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da. And the other is before the beat, da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da. And both have arguments for and against.
Mm-hmm.
There was kind of a transition going in performance practice right around that time. And so one could imagine Beethoven going one way or the other. And when you look at the orchestra score, you can't tell because the instrument that has that line is just playing those notes. And all the other notes in the other instruments are on different staves. And so they're not lined up perfectly. You can't tell from that exactly what Beethoven meant. But when Liszt transcribes it, he had to put it all on the same staff, and so all the notes are compressed together, and so the alignment is extremely important and significant. And in his version, the grace note comes before the note. Da-da, da-da-da-da-da.
Wow.
And that's something that's not heard so much today or even in any of the major 20th century recordings. Most of them are on the beat.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few conductors. I played the transcription for Gerard Schwartz, for example, who has made quite a career of performing the seventh. He knows it very, very well, and I was very excited to play it for him. And he said, I play the grace note before the beat. And at the time, that was early on when I was working on the piece, and I hadn't really established some of my thinking about it. But I took his experience and his perspective really seriously, and so I started playing it that way. And as soon as I did, all of a sudden, a few of the measures in the score suddenly became clear to me. That's why Liszt wrote it that way. You could only play it that way with those fingerings that he marked in if you played it before the beat.
Wow.
And so literally that changed my complete idea of what this transcription was. It's not just the orchestra transcribed for piano. It's an actual recording of performance practice of Beethoven's time.
Wow.
And it really became a huge opening for me. And so I'm very indebted to Jerry for that insight. That was really wonderful.
Yeah, I'll bet. And one of the things that I'm curious about, because I know you've spent your career finding really fascinating transcriptions from all different composers. But this one in particular, it seems as though Liszt really put a lot of himself into these transcriptions in addition to just making it a carbon copy of a Beethoven symphony.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sliding scale in the Liszt universe as to how much of his own personality went in. Somewhat related to how competent the composer that he's transcribing is. like when he's transcribing Donizetti, who is a great composer, but not like a super serious composer. Liszt took a lot of liberties.
Yeah.
When he transcribed Schubert, who was, of course, an incredible genius composer, but who had limited means in terms of the piano, he supplemented that a little bit. In terms of Beethoven, you can tell that Liszt really had the utmost respect for Beethoven as both a performer and as a composer, because he almost didn't change a thing. And of course, that's impossible to just take the notes in the orchestra score and just put each one of them into the piano score and play whatever's there. That's just impossible, and it wouldn't sound good. There are many passages that have to be rethought, rewritten to be pianistic in order for it to sound like the orchestra version.
Wow.
Which is kind of strange.
It's a paradox, yeah.
Yeah, but there are idioms in one language that need to be translated into another idiom in the new language, and they are parallel to each other without being copies of each other. And that's what Liszt understood. And so in some ways, you can say you see Liszt all over the place in these Beethoven transcriptions. On the other hand, if you really just listen to the music, you lose yourself and you really start hearing an orchestral piece, but it's all done through pianistic means.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating, fascinating.
It must be so interesting to get inside it. I mean, have you ever conducted an orchestra?
No. Well, that's why I'm a pianist, so
right,
I don't have to conduct.
Right, exactly. Because I was thinking this would give you sort of the same freedom, I guess, that a conductor would have with an orchestra at your disposal.
I can imagine being a conductor and having a great thrill producing this. I think one of the great things about the piano is that one person has the opportunity to sit down in front of the instrument and, with practice, of course, sit down and alone can produce whatever he or she wants to produce right there in real time with no rehearsals, no negotiating, not even having to state out loud what you're trying to do, but just following your musical instincts. And that's something that I don't think even the greatest conductor would have the privilege of doing, because it's teamwork when you're talking about orchestra. It's a very different thing when you're talking about piano.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to talk with you about was what are some of the what can you do as a pianist performing this that a conductor couldn't do? And I guess that's one of the things.
I've listened to the great versions, and in those I can hear changes of tempo, molding of phrases that I think are amazing for an orchestra to produce. And that comes from the conductor controlling and molding and shaping. And I I imagine it took a lot of work or a lot of coordination and experience to do that. I can do that. You know, I can do one after another, changing the shape of the phrase however I want until I get the right one. And then I can change it in the middle of the performance.
Mm-hmm.
So those, you know, those little details I can do on my own without negotiating. And those over time and over the course of the piece build up to something that becomes, something quite unique to piano versus orchestra. I don't think an orchestra can ever do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The other thing, I think, which is so unique to piano is the fact that, you know, Beethoven's symphonies, of course, are multiple instruments, multiple voices coming together. And that's an amazing thing for one to experience, both inside as one of the voices,
mm-hmm.
or from the outside listening to and watching all of these people come together in perfect teamwork and collaboration to produce something that's greater than any of the people, you know, the whole greater than the sum of the parts. For piano, there's an added element which is kind of added on to that, which is you hear all the different voices and you realize how amazing it is that they all fit together and produce this result. But then you realize that, wow, it's actually just one person putting all of those voices out there and melding them together.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the unique roles that the piano can play in even just generally and philosophically for someone who looks at teamwork and collaboration as one side of a coin and the other side of the coin being one person can do multiple things at the same time.
Yeah.
So our ability to collaborate and work on a team is matched by our ability to be the team.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, to have multiple voices in our head, to have multiple specialties, to have multiple interests. And I think that's something that as humans we need to practice, and piano is a great place to practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because yeah. Every time you sit down at the keyboard, you're basically, your fingers are multitasking.
Yeah,
and yet,
right away, yeah. Right in the first lesson, mm-hmm. melody, accompaniment. Mm-hmm. Play this, that's accompaniment. Play this, that's a melody. Boom, you're multitasking.
Yeah.
Whether you want to or not. And of course, every musical instrument requires multitasking. You know, you got your two hands, you got your feet, you know, drummers, everybody's multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
But this very conscious multitasking, which is required in piano, is something that I think starts sooner for pianists than for other musicians, and certainly is the key to having great piano, is to have that ability to control the two hands independently, to control each of the fingers independently, and then to control the voices and all the different lines that come together in a piano piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you throw the pedals in too.
And then you throw the pedals in to mix it all
yeah.
up. And then how to communicate that to the audience, mm-hmm. so that the audience is like, oh, I'm hearing multiple things.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody has this multi-layered experience, which is so wonderful.
Well, as you're playing these incredible transcriptions, are you thinking about the different instruments that Beethoven used, like
oh,
the
yeah.
beautiful oboe in the
Absolutely.
First movement of the seventh? Well, then how do you reproduce that sound or those voices?
Yeah, so here's a place where, you know, the piano is limited. The sound of the piano is pretty much a very narrow range of variation and has nothing at all on the variety of instrumental timbres in an orchestra. But within our very narrow range, we do have an infinite number of gradations. And one of the challenges for me, for all pianists doing this, is how to emphasize those differences as much as possible, how to be consistent so that the audience over the course of a concert starts developing a finer and finer ear for that very infinite graded palette.
Yeah.
And then to use other things besides color to make sure the audience hears multiple voices, articulation, dynamics, pedal use, the attack of the notes, sharp attack, soft attack, all of those things combined into a package makes one think, oh, that sounds a little more flute-like than that, which sounds a little more oboe-like. Hmm. You know, the flute is maybe a little rounder, a little more fuzzy on the edges. Oboe's very sharp and defined on the edges, even though they're both in the high register. So you have a difference of attack and a difference of loudness, and all of a sudden, oh, that loud thing sounds a little more like oboe. Oh, that soft thing sounds a little more like flute. And the more you emphasize those things, the more you start hearing them as two different instruments. And all of a sudden, here you are at the piano playing an oboe and playing a flute. And it's a beautiful moment when that happens.
That's just fascinating. Because one of the things I was wondering, I heard you play the Seventh Symphony live at the Sanctuary Series. And it was such a fascinating experience because I could hear the instruments in my head. But there were moments where I just sort of forgot and just got into just hearing nothing but the piano. Yeah. It's just
well, I think in this particular case with the symphony transcriptions, it helps to have heard the symphonies played by an orchestra. But then it also helps you listen to the orchestra version to hear the transcription and to really hear the music. It's kind of like an X-ray. You can see like the structures, how they all fit together. The oboe may not sound like an oboe and the flute may not sound like a flute, but you can certainly have the idea that here are these two voices that are in the same range and they're kind of intertwining, they're pairing together, they're fighting each other.
Yeah.
And then you go back and listen to the orchestra version and it's like, oh, wow, I never heard that before, or I never noticed those things, or it just becomes this much more enriched kind of version because your ear has been trained to do that more.
Yeah.
I'm going to have another opportunity to play this live at the Westport Library. This is part of our Beechwood winter season on March 5th. It's going to be a very special concert. It's part of our winter season with the theme Do or Die. Hmm. And we're focusing on Beethoven's Heiligenstadt Testament, where he basically doubles down on composing and doubles down on living through composing. And we're going to have a very technologically advanced connection between Westport and New York. We're going to actually have a concert in both places live, and the pianos are going to be talking to each other and playing each other.
Wow.
During this performance.
Wow.
So that's something for people to mark in their calendars.
Yeah. Is there going to be an actual pianist at the site in New York too? Or?
So in Westport, I will be there playing the seventh live, and I will be remote controlling the piano in New York.
Oh, wow.
Where an audience there will hear it from the piano there, but with a video of me. And then I have two young pianists in New York who are going to play a four-hand version of the Ninth Symphony.
Oh, wow.
Live there for their audience, and they're going to be remote controlling the piano in Westport, and we're going to see them up on the big screen and hear the Ninth Symphony on the piano.
So
it's going to be really pretty spectacular.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That is just so cool. So you mentioned that these are spectacularly difficult to play. I mean, besides just the musicianship and the thought that goes into preparing this physically, what makes it a challenge?
I think one of the main things that is hard is the relentless energy that Beethoven demands of the music. And with an orchestra, you can have all these instruments kind of passing it from one to the other, but keeping the beat going and just keeping it pushing and pushing and pushing. And of course, you have like 15 string players, you know, like all playing together. So it can create a big sound, and that energy can continue. For the pianist, it's just a pianist. And it's the same energy and that relentlessness that has to be communicated. And that's just taxing physically. The stamina is just incredibly difficult. And there's not much in the piano repertoire that requires that kind of energy. And then the other thing is emotionally, it's so difficult to keep the edge of emotions like right there and be in control of all these technical things to be able to play them.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge with any high emotional music like Chopin or Brahms. But with Beethoven, these symphony transcriptions, you're also adding that technical challenge along with the emotional challenge. And so the two of those things just make it almost impossible to play.
Oh, man. Well, then no wonder people avoid them.
I think that's the first barrier.
Yeah, to hearing these.
Yeah. So I'm very happy to have this recording out. They were produced by Judy Sherman, who's a great producer. She's won the Grammy for classical producing multiple times. And it was wonderful to work with her, get her insight, and also using the disclavier, the Yamaha disclavier, to record with a very special editing process that actually encourages musicality versus a search for perfection. Mm-hmm. Of course, the recording is perfect, quote unquote, but to get there, you can arrive from different directions with different results. And the disclavier method of recording is just an absolutely incredible, revolutionary approach. And that's something that I'm pushing as well.
Wow. Well, it's been fascinating to talk with you about this. And congratulations on the release.
Thank you.
It's great. And we'll all look forward to the concert.
Thank you. As you can tell, I'm very excited about this. So I hope everybody goes out and buys a CD if you have a CD player or stream or download, whatever, and come to the March 5th concert at the Westport Library.
All right. Thanks so much, Frederick.
Thank you, Kate.